on this week's program, there's been a lot of good news emanating recently from the Opera Company of Philadelphia. We speak with its general director, David Devan. Susan Lewis profiles the Philadelphia-based Baroque ensemble Tempesta de Mare. David Patrick Stearns looks at the National Association of Negro Musicians. And we speak with the Philadelphia-based contemporary artist Tristan Lowe. His Under the Influence, an installation comprised of two interconnected works, is currently in view at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
At a time when many arts groups are struggling, the Opera Company of Philadelphia is doing very nicely, thank you very much indeed. In addition to a balanced budget, yearly commissions, main stage productions and a successful chamber series, the company has been breaking new ground. It recently named its first composer in residence, and an opening night simulcast on Independence Mall drew several thousand people. The Opera Company has made particularly strong strides in the last 5 years, when longtime artistic director Robert Driver hired David Devan, now the company's general director. The Opera Company of Philadelphia, as arts organizations go, is in pretty good condition. Balanced budget, composer in residence, new commissions, a very successful chamber series. It goes on and on. Is there a secret sauce for this, and when can we start to buy it?
The secret sauce is teamwork. We've spent the last 5 years building a team to make this all work, starting with the board of directors who totally gets and supports our mission. And we've put together a really fantastic management team in support of that effort. And we're just firing on all cylinders in every department, in every part of governance, because I think we've just got the right people around the table.
There is a certain false modesty to this, because a lot of this you were the catalyst for when you came in 5 years ago. The company was doing well. It wasn't doing great. And it's now doing a lot better. When you came in, what did you see? What did you want to change? And how has that change come about?
What I saw was a good foundation to build from. And Robert Driver and I started sort of putting together a program that would work. And basically, my job was to try and harness all the good stuff that came before me and to try and plot a path. And that path basically is what I'd call a differentiated path. To be an opera company in Philadelphia, an hour and a half out of New York, in the middle of a very dense cultural market in itself, we needed to pursue an artistically differentiated experience, both in terms of offerings from other opera companies as well as other classical arts institutions. And we needed a strong business plan in support of that. The starting point for sort of our redesign was an aspiration that we want to become amongst the five most influential opera companies in the country.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty strong aspiration.
It is. This was born out of about 8 months of facilitated discussion with the board of directors about our mission and a critical analysis of where we really stood in relationship to our peer group. And so we created an influence index with four variables. And the four variables are scope. You need enough scope of artistic activity that you can produce and develop a broad range of artistic experiences. Second is a talent, that you hire the best talent for that job. That doesn't mean you hire the best soprano in the world. You know, it doesn't mean you hire Renee Fleming for all
for, things, for everything.
For everything. It means that if you're doing a Mozart, that maybe it's an emerging singer from Curtis that can do that role the very best at that time in their career. So a real discernment over talent, and we see that as having a real commitment to emerging talent.
And the side effect of that, of course, is that audiences get to say, I knew her or I knew him
exactly.
When.
Exactly.
And they feel that they're part of the process as well, because they're seeing this great emerging talent who will, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years later, be a huge international star,
exactly.
Perhaps.
Exactly. Remember, the job, if it's influence, is if you're helping develop the future talent, then you get gold stars besides your name for being an influencer. Third variable is creativity. So you don't build a new production just because you can't find one to rent. You build one because there's something artistically to say. And so what we've done there is we wanted to make ourselves a center for co-productions with other companies so that we could bring as much new creative force into the company at a price we could afford. Fourth is what we call the X factor. The X factor is distinctiveness of place, that your culture as an institution has to reflect the people and the place that you occupy. So for us, that's Philadelphia. So thinking about that, we're the original American city. We were and are a place of great innovation. So what we try to pepper into everything that we do is that spirit of innovation and being exciting and fresh that really honors the founding of the city and of the country.
Opera Company Philadelphia General Director David Devan.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Four Seasons may be among the most popular and well-known works of Baroque music, but it was another work by Vivaldi that was the inspiration for the name of a Philadelphia-based Baroque orchestra. Now in its 10th season, Tempesta di Mare continues to explore the tempestuous nature of Baroque music, playing new discoveries alongside more familiar fare. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the group and its 21st century take on 18th century music.
It was the mid-90s when recorder soloist Gwyn Roberts was making a CD, and the producer asked what the group playing with her was called. She and her husband and professional partner, lute player Richard Stone, cast about for a name, and a Vivaldi concerto about a storm at sea came to mind.
We chose the name Tempesta di Mare because it reflected Baroque composers' belief in the power of music to evoke drama.
Originally a vehicle for Roberts and Stone's chamber projects, Tempesta di Mare evolved into an independent orchestral ensemble with a mission to do newly discovered works, as well as familiar pieces, without a conductor and with heightened expression. For those who don't think of Baroque music as inherently dramatic, Gwyn Roberts says the performance practice has changed over the years, and something got lost along the way.
When Baroque music was new, there was this entire language of the performer that's described in a lot of the manuals that talk about how to play music and how to play your instrument and how to be a singer that survive from the time. And it's a very dramatic, passionate, contrasty language of the performer that is an entire set of things that you do when the music on the page does certain things. Since the composers assumed that performers would do all of those things, they didn't have to include it in the score. In fact, they don't.
When Baroque music was revived in the 19th century, embellishments were added to the scores, creating a kind of over-romanticized form. Somewhere in the middle of the 20th century, says Roberts, musicians began reacting against those changes.
And they made an attempt to back away from the schmaltziness of the 19th century, and they took all those extra markings out. But what they then played in their attempt at purity was just what the composers had written, which is only about half the story. And that's why you get these very bland, very even, very uninflected performances.
In recent years, using performance manuals that survived the centuries, Tempesta di Mare musicians are among those who have worked to put drama back into the music. It is this heightened role of the performer in interpreting the lights and darks, the loud and soft, the changing pace and inflections that has drawn people like Roberts and Stone to the repertoire and to period or copies of period instruments. Richard Stone plays a Baroque guitar, a large stringed instrument called a theorba, described by Stone as a lute on steroids, and a 24-stringed lute.
When I first played lute music on the lute, it was a sound and a sensation I'd never experienced before. And there was a brightness and transparency to the sound. There was also a naturalness of the way the fingers worked on the instruments to create those sounds.
Period-style instruments are better suited to the repertoire, says Emlyn Nye, who in addition to playing modern violin in concert, plays the Baroque violin in his capacity as Tempesta di Mare's concertmaster.
When you use modern instruments, you have covered strings. They're usually wound or they're steel. And so you get a certain kind of color that is sometimes too bright, too penetrating. And the blend doesn't always come out successful. And also the bows tend to not allow you to speak the music, to articulate in a speech-like fashion, which is what all 17th and 18th century music is all about.
Making music like speech?
Imagine reading a poem. You get either a very straight, literal recitation of the poem with no inflection versus one that uses your voice to bring out what's interesting in it. You know, there's a monster under the couch, or there's a monster under the couch. Ah, that's the difference.
Roberts and Stone take this approach to a repertoire that is constantly expanding with the discovery of new music, or rather, old music that is new to contemporary ears.
It's getting unearthed in all sorts of locations, primarily in Europe. We've done a lot of things with music that was lost during World War II in Germany in one way or another. Things that were in the library in Dresden and then stuffed into vaults underneath the library to escape the bombing, but then flooded and only recently dug back out and discovered that, well, yes, they're a little water damaged, but they're still usable.
Tempesta di Mare focused for 4 years on a lesser-known contemporary of Bach named Johann Friedrich Fasch, much of whose music was lost in Dresden and has only recently come to light.
We'll occasionally go directly to those collections, or our publisher friends will send us CDs with images of the manuscripts, and we'll look at those and occasionally reassemble them. When there's damage to the notes, I figure out what the original notes might likely be.
Once the music is recreated, Tempesta di Mare musicians work on articulating it, giving different expression, for example, to musical ideas that repeat. Here, in Fasch's Concerto in G.
The beginning of the concerto has a little figure that goes like this. And the passage sounds like... So it comes up a few times, and you can either play them exactly the same, or you could try to change them so that they create some kind of logical expression, as in a sentence.
Musicians follow their section leaders, concertmaster Emlyn Nye on strings, Gwyn Roberts, winds, and Richard Stone, the continuo.
When you say continuo, it's a double-meaning word. So there's the composed bass line, and that's referred to as the basso or the basso continuo. But then there's the practice of continuo, and that's what the chordal instruments do, an organ, a harp, a lute, a guitar. We improvise harmony and counterpoint above the composed bass line, sort of sandwiching it in between the treble melody and the composed bass melody and all this improvised stuff that we do. So we add rhythmic accent to it as well as some melodic and harmonic accent to it.
Lights and darks, improvisation and musical conversation.
There's a lot of interplay and a lot of interaction that happens amongst musicians spontaneously. It's not always planned, and that makes the performance very much alive, very much of the moment.
Over the last decade, the ensemble has performed 26 modern world premieres and dozens of modern regional premieres, and has also played works as familiar as Bach's Brandenburg concertos. Tempesta di Mare continues to explore the musical landscape, mining new discoveries in old repertoire, known and still unknown.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Tempesta di Mare next performs a week from today at 8 o'clock at the Art Street Friends Meeting House in Center City, Philadelphia, and the following day at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill at 4 in the afternoon.
He's got the whole world in his hands, he's got the big round world in
Long before the legendary Philadelphia singer Marian Anderson had the whole music world in her hands, she was the recipient of a scholarship from the National Association of Negro Musicians, an organization that's still alive today after 92 years, and this June held its annual national convention in Philadelphia. Highlights included a vocal extravaganza concert featuring Marietta Simpson, Marquita Lister, and Donnie Ray Albert, among others, in opera arias, duets, and ensembles. It ended with music that continues to be a particular cause for the association. Many of its members believe that music rooted in the ancient and spiritual tradition is in grave danger. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns examines the history and current mission of the National Association of Negro Musicians.
At first, one might look at the National Association of Negro Musicians and find them, a bit pre-Obama. However, consistency, longevity, and a very non-hip-hop philosophy of self-presentation is the hallmark of the NANM, as it's called for short, especially in the Philadelphia chapter the W. Russell Johnson Music Guild formed 90 years ago. The organization isn't high profile, the scholarship money isn't huge, but the moral support, says noted mezzo-soprano Marietta Simpson, can carry you through when talent just isn't enough.
I do believe that talent opens doors, but I think people are behind the doors that help open them. So someone over here can recognize a gift in you and really support that and nurture and put you in contact with other people. And somebody over here can be not so impressed. The problem sometimes gets that people are tired by the time the opportunity comes and they're not ready. And so they can't take full advantage of it. And life is funny. One month you can be doing really, really well, and then 6 months later, you're thinking, does anybody know my name out there?
The legendary conductor Robert Shaw knew her name and hired her in engagements that made her name. Now, Simpson is a full professor of voice at Indiana University. Others had a longer wait. Hazel Jefferson, vice president of the local chapter, is of the generation before Simpson and one that sometimes had to put musical aspirations on hold, in her case, until after retirement from UPS.
I had an excellent career with them. When I first graduated high school, my parents could not afford to send me to college. As time went on, I got married, got divorced, and then I started taking one class at a time until I could, complete my education. Now I teach voice and piano at a performing arts center in Kennett Square.
Careers are defined a bit differently here. The bottom line is having a life in music. Many of the members have gone into opera and oratorio, but some have been lifelong church musicians and educators. Veteran pianist Blanche Burton Lyles, who is being honored in this year's convention, has done all those things. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from the Curtis Institute and play solo with the New York Philharmonic. But you won't hear her complaining that she didn't go on to the Berlin Philharmonic. Instead, she created the Marian Anderson Residence Museum and has long guided others, partly through teaching in the school system, partly through her own good counsel.
My parents gave me this, always do your best. You've been given a talent, so it's your responsibility. You don't hide it. And there's sometimes you may not get paid, but look at the opportunity you might offer someone. I taught more than 33 years in the system. I was always a pianist who taught.
Her curriculum included concert manners, knowing when to applaud, and how to dress. You'll never see her with a single hair out of place. And you can see that also in her protege, a 20-something Philadelphia pianist named Dynasty Battles, who illustrates how music careers can strike even in the most unsuspecting households.
My older sister, Wanisha, she was taking lessons when I was around 3 or 4 years old, and I wanted to be like my big sister. And plus, she sounded good, so that inspired me to want to learn the piano.
Now, he's a product of the Settlement Music School and has also finished his first year at Temple University. He plays concerts arranged by the NANM and, as often as possible, plays the Piano Sonata No. 1 by African-American composer George Walker. Some may find the piece naughty and difficult. He doesn't.
I can feel the lines that are in the music. I can definitely feel it. I can feel the shape of the notes. And it comes easy for me to play it. It's like I'm playing something out of my own life, from my own experience.
No matter how far afield these musicians go, the Philadelphia chapter of the association believes in having a firm grounding in the spirituals, which they believe is essential to their heritage and is being smothered by gospel, as Hazel Jefferson explains.
It's a big difference. It all started with the spiritual. The spiritual started with the slaves. They all came out of an experience.
It's hard to imagine how that world could inform the geographically and culturally different music often performed by Marietta Simpson, heard here in the world premiere recording of Credo by the Polish composer Krzysztof Penderecki.
The thing that's basic to all music, whether it's folk music or classically composed music, is that there's a subtext that goes on that you're always trying to evoke for other people. And when you sing the spirituals, the basic tenet of it is an emotional connection. There's the message, but there's everything that's not said, that's not in the words, that you have to bring to the piece. And I think that's true with Schubert, it's true with Beethoven, it's true with Penderecki, that any note that's on the page, you have to bring life to.
And the results are anything but timid.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. So our next item takes us out of the studio and into the Perelman Building at the Philadelphia Museum of Art to view a work by a Boston-born, Philadelphia-based artist, Tristan Lowe. The work is called Under the Influence, and it's in the form of two installations interconnected by another part of the art. Maybe you should explain exactly what it looks like and why it looks this way. What are we looking at here? Right, this is like a comet, right?
Yeah, outside we have a comet, and this one's called Nature, Comet as Nature. This sort of introduces you into the space. Inside we have the moon, right, which has over half a billion craters on it, not the one in there, but the real one, and all those impacts were made by comets and meteors and stuff like that. So we have a neon red comet that's basically sort of like a 3D drawing, probably about 8 or 9 feet up, so you can walk right under it.
So that's the first thing we see, is this red neon comet. Then we approach what can only be described as either an Alice in Wonderland or a Jonathan Swiftian type door. This door is here to make us feel small?
I don't know about to make you feel small, but to make you feel maybe like a kid again a little bit. And to make you realize, like, how a door functions, it really does bring you into another space, and to make this a really otherworldly kind of space.
And we're also moving from the light into the dark.
Yeah. And so in here we have, literally, we're stepping into another space, into space.
And it's really dark. One side of the room is dark, and the other side of the room is blue lit, right?
Yeah, the darks, the far side of the moon is blue. But, yeah, it creates a nice night sky, if you will, blue. A nice dusk or so. And then here we have the moon, which is rendered in felt. It's done all these craters sort of tweezed into the felt. Kind of crazy, labor-intensive process.
Well, particularly when we know of your history a little bit, that you've worked in other less sophisticated materials, chocolate, butter, found materials. There's a great deal of craft involved in this. How much of this is your handiwork? I mean, the neon, the door,
I don't bend the
brass door lock.
Those are all mine. Wow. I raise the metal. Yeah. I mean, I like all the different, all material speaks in a different way, kind of. So I think there's attributes
But you have
I
to know its language, clearly, in the first place. How did you go
get
around?
Your hands
I'm going
in
to
there.
Make you, I'm going to make.
What, a keyhole?
Well, not a keyhole. You're making an entire lock, right? Or at least the impression of a lock.
Yes. I don't have the little mechanism. I didn't finish it. But the other parts of it, for all intents and purposes, are separate parts and everything. Yeah. The doorknob. I did metal work a little bit, you know, steel work in school. And I still love that material. So it's great. You know, I have a welder and TIG welder and grinders and things like that.
The machines, not the people.
Yeah, not the people.
And then why choose felt for the moon? Because it works remarkably well. Clearly, not many of us have been to the moon, but this is what it would, not made of cheese at all, made of felt. That's the new headline, isn't it?
Actually, the moon kind of stems from this other piece I did, this big whale. I did this full-size whale, a 52-foot-long sperm whale. It's not here. It's at the Virginia Museum. But Moby Dick was based on a real whale called Mocha Dick, and he was described in 1839 in a Knickerbocker magazine as being white as wool and a head encrusted in barnacles. And in a weird way, working out the surface of the whale, because he's so huge at times, it was really important to sort of get enough detail and stuff into the surface that you weren't just looking at a big blank sheet of felt. So the barnacles and the stitching and stuff, that sort of led to like a topographical look, like at times. And that sort of landscape that started to get on there made me start thinking about the moon and the craters. And I think there's over 500,000 or 500,000,000 craters. I mean, that's the amazing thing, is that the moon is this great map of everything that's happened to it.
So tell me about the experience, though, of walking from the day-lit, comet-laden sky through this childlike door into this impression of the moon, I guess as seen from space rather than from Earth. Is there a narrative to this?
I think that, well, the moon and the under-the-influence aspect is just how the moon
lunacy,
is...
Lunacy, right.
Yeah, lunacy, but also the moon, the days of the week, the months, all this stuff has been based on the cycles of the moon. And then there's, you know, the lunacy aspect, but also, like, I think actually the Hebrew calendar works off of the moon. And, like, we all have this kind of intimate experience with the moon, yet we have never been near it or anything, but we all have this sort of, you know, it's, I mean, there's a little bit of that surrealistic, I guess, aspect to it.
It's a very evocative experience going through the, I guess, exhibition, the installation, the work. What do you hope people are going to have a mood change as they experience it?
I hope they have I want them to have an encounter that they wouldn't otherwise have, basically. I don't know what that is, and I don't want to dictate what that is. I think we all kind of come to, you know, like I said, with the moon, it's a funny thing. It's like a kid can draw a crescent in the top corner of his paper and everybody knows it's the moon. So we all do, and this is maybe more to the size of maybe the Little Prince's moon, you know, B612 or whatever, but it's still...
It's like, an imposing piece as well. About 15 feet
I feel like it's
tall?
A real... No, it's only 12 and a half feet tall, but it's about 40 feet around.
Can I ask you then, without wishing to define what we should experience in encountering this, every concept... Is it fair to say that every artistic concept looks better when it's rendered?
I don't know about that.
Okay, let me ask you more personally. Is every artistic concept of yours better when it's rendered?
I don't know if I can say that either. I mean, I can't. I did something honoring or something like the moon, like this connection, right? But in no way does it get to a greater experience than really walking out and seeing the moon every night.
Okay, you know, but does it do to you what you hoped it would?
Yeah, I think, and it showed me other things that I didn't know that weren't gonna happen. Like the introducing visitor into it really created an atmosphere and a space. I mean, that's what we're in a way trying to drop out the white walls of the gallery and just have you have a more of a relationship one to one with the objects, so that the space kind of goes away and you're in space in a way. So just trying to set up a context and a place that you wouldn't otherwise be able to be.
Tristan Lowe. His Under the Influence is on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perelman Building through January 29th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.